Distributing the Future, broadcast number 8.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week, Linda Stone talks about continuous partial attention in an excerpt from her speech at Supernova 2005, courtesy of IT Conversations. Paul Graham looks at the difference between amateurs and professionals. Ernie Provaca traces open source's path from infancy to adolescence. And we answer a listener concern about our coverage of the Sony DRM piece in our last program. Distributing the Future is brought to you by Make Magazine, technology on your time. In Volume 4, cool holiday kits, build a cigar box guitar, circuit bending, high-speed flash photography, coffee hacks, and lots of cool DIY music projects. Visit makezine.com. What are you doing right now? Yeah, you. While you're listening to this week's show, are you checking email, writing code, driving? Eating? Chances are you're doing something. We don't tend to just do one thing at a time anymore. The woman who sits next to me at soccer practice spends the entire hour on the phone while her kids run around me and the other parents screaming. On the way home, I stop at a light and look at the guy next to me. Finally, a driver who's not on the phone while he's driving. I look again. He's reading a book. What is it about our generation that's moved multitasking up a notch to where we only seem to be partly engaged in any one activity? Linda Stone, who's now retired from Microsoft and Apple, spoke on this phenomenon of continuous partial attention at Supernova 2005. You'll also find a link to IT Conversations, where you'll find the entire talk as well as the panel discussion that followed in our show notes.
With continuous partial attention, we keep the top-level item in focus, and then we scan the periphery in case something more important emerges. Speed, agility, and connectivity have been top of mind, and marketers have been humming that tune for almost 2 decades now. Between the extraordinary amount of information technology available today, the need to network, and the always-on lifestyle, we are increasingly overstimulated, overwhelmed, and unfulfilled. Are some of you beginning to ignore call waiting now and then? Do you cherish these technology-free moments here and there? We don't make decisions anymore. We send emails around, terrible way to make decisions, or go into meetings and try to make decisions collaboratively, and we end up stalling on making decisions or not making decisions at all. Someone recently told me that their CEO requires everyone, when they walk into a meeting, to drop their laptops, cell phones, and Blackberries at the door. Attention is not a static thing, it's dynamic, and that there are socio-cultural influences that push us in one direction or another to pay attention in one way or another. So I'm going to jump back to 1945 to 1965. Some of you, but not many of you, actually remember that time. The organization or the institution was the center of gravity, and we trusted authority. We paid full focus attention to that which served the institution or the organization. On television, Lucy, when she spoke to Ethel, she paid full focus attention to that phone conversation. Seinfeld does not do that. Have you noticed? So there's real shift in pop culture to how that works, too. There was a belief that by serving the institution of marriage, an employer, one's community, that we would lead happy and well-ordered lives. Marketing messages, command-control management style, parents as authority figures, all fit into this set of ideals. We believe that service to the institution and to the institutions in our lives would bring us ultimate satisfaction. And we paid full focus attention to our jobs, our marriages, our community, our company, to that which served the institution, to that which was all about authority. In fact, we trusted the experts and the authority to filter the signal and noise and the information in our life. We counted on them to give us the information that mattered. As this set of beliefs ceased to serve us, unhappy marriages, corporate downsizing, we embraced what had been most suppressed for 2 decades. And that takes us to 1965, which was really all about me, self-expression. So after this 20-year period of really serving institutions, trusting authority, what emerged was this 20-year period that was all about self-expression and all about me. Self and self-expression was a new center of gravity. We trusted ourselves. We were entrepreneurial. We moved from command control management to an entrepreneurial style of management. Companies like Apple, Microsoft, and Southwest Airlines emerged. Marketers told us that we had the power to be our best. Self-expression in fashion broke free from the constraints of the previous eras. We paid attention to that which created personal opportunities. We gave full focus attention to software like Word and Excel because it was about creating opportunity for us. And we were willing to fragment our attention if it enhanced our personal opportunity because we were all about opportunity creation. Multitasking, doing many things at one time in an effort to be more productive and efficient, was a super functional adapted behavior. Our sense of commitment deteriorated from one employer in a lifetime to three, and in marriage, from one marriage, for better or for worse, to a rising divorce rate. 20 years of all about me took a toll on us. We were increasingly narcissistic and lonely. And when you're narcissistic and lonely, what do? You reach out for a network. So 1985 to 2005, which is where we are now, these last 20 years, the network's been the center of gravity. We trust network intelligence. Having generated lots of opportunity, we now scan for opportunity. And continuous partial attention is a post-multitasking adaptive behavior. It used to be that productivity and getting a lot of things done made us feel alive. And now being connected is what makes us feel alive, and continuous partial attention is the adaptation of that. I think ADD is a dysfunctional variant of continuous partial attention. Continuous partial attention is not motivated by productivity. It's all motivated by being connected. Technologies like MySpace, Friendster, where quantity of connections appears to be desirable, may make us feel connected, but the lack of meaningfulness in these connections underscores just how promiscuous and how empty this way of life has become. To quote Dan Gould, who's wandering around here somewhere, I quit every social network I was on so I would have time to have dinner with people. We had years of invincibility in the last cycle. This next cycle is marked by a greater level of fear. Our attention is increasingly captured by companies, leaders, marketing messages that give us a sense of trust, a sense of protection, and a sense of belonging in a meaningful way. In the last era, technology was our aphrodisiac, and we surrendered to the possibilities. Now many of us find ourselves longing for a quality of life that comes in these moments of meaningful connections to friends, family, and colleagues that we experience when we focus fully on problem-solving, creative work, and relationships, cutting off all interruptions. Steve Gilmore asked me what the new aphrodisiac will be. And the aphrodisiac in the coming era is committed attention, intention, and focus. Is there a higher compliment than somebody giving you their full attention? In this new era, experiencing this engaged attention is to feel alive. Trusted filters, trusted protectors, a trusted concierge, either human or technical, that removes distractions, that helps manage our boundaries, that filters signal from noise, that enables meaningful connections, that makes us feel secure.
Linda Stone on continuous partial attention. Maybe the problem isn't us so much as it is our work environment. Maybe if we were working on something we loved in an environment like our home or apartment, we could get more done. Paul Graham's OSCON 2005 keynote began with open source, but quickly made the point that the issue was not that the source was open or that the code was free. The real lesson was in how software is created, committed people spending time working on things that are important to them. He draws analogies to the difference between bloggers and professional writers. As Distributing the Future listeners know, the world isn't just changing. It's already changed.
Like open source, blogging is something people do themselves for free because they enjoy it. Like open source hackers, bloggers compete with people working for money and often win. I think the most important of the new principles business has to learn from the world of open source is that people work a lot harder on things they like. I think we were designed to work just as we were designed to eat a certain amount of fiber, and we feel bad if we don't. Well, there's a name for people who work for the love of it. Amateurs. That word now has such bad connotations that we forget its etymology, though it's staring us in the face. Amateur was originally rather a complimentary word, but the thing to be in the 20th century was professional, which amateurs, by definition, are not. That's why the business world was surprised by another lesson from open source, that people working for love often surpass those working for money. Most users who switch from Explorer to Firefox don't do it because they want to hack the source. They switch because it's a better browser. Well, it's not like Microsoft isn't trying. They know that controlling the browser is one of the keys to retaining their monopoly. I suspect professionalism was always overrated, not just in the literal sense of working for money, but also connotations like formality and detachment. Inconceivable as it would have seemed in, say, 1970, I think professionalism was partly just a fashion driven by conditions that happened to prevail in the 20th century. One of the most powerful of these was the existence of channels. Revealingly, the same word was used for both products and information. There were distribution channels and TV and radio channels. And it was these channels that made professionals seem so superior to amateurs. There were only a few jobs as professional journalists, for example. And so that competition meant the average journalist was pretty good, whereas anyone can express his opinions about current events in a bar. And so the average person expressing his opinions in a bar sounds like an idiot compared to a professional journalist writing about the topic. On the web, the barrier for publishing your ideas is even lower. You don't have to buy a drink, and they let kids in. Millions of amateurs are now publishing online, and the level of what they're writing, as you might expect, is not very good. This has led a few in the print media to conclude that blogs don't present much of a threat, that blogs are just a fad. Actually, the fad is the word blog, at least the way the print media now use it. If you pay attention, the way they use the word blogger, they mean anybody who publishes online, not just someone who publishes in a weblog format. That's going to become a problem as the web becomes the default medium for publication. I don't like to coin phrases, but I think now is the time to do it. I'd like to suggest an alternative word for someone who publishes online. How about writer? Those in the print media who dismiss the writing online because of its low average quality are missing an important point. No one reads the average blog. In the old world of channels, it meant something to talk about average quality because that's what everyone was getting, whether they liked it or not. But now you can read any writer you want. So the average quality of writing online isn't what the print media are competing against. They're competing against the best writing online, and like Microsoft, they're losing. Aggregators show how much better you can do than the channel. The Times front page is a list of articles written by people who work for the New York Times. Delicious is a list of articles that are interesting. And it's only now that you can see the two side by side that you can see how little overlap there is. A child gets abducted. There's a tornado. A ferry sinks. Someone gets bitten by a shark. A small plane crashes. And what do you learn about the world from these stories? Absolutely nothing. They're outlying data points. What makes them gripping also makes them irrelevant. As in software, when professionals produce such crap, it's not surprising if amateurs can do better. Live by the channel, die by the channel. If you depend on an oligopoly, you sink into bad habits that are hard to overcome when you suddenly get competition. Another thing blogs and open source software have in common is that they're often made by people working at home. Well, that may not seem surprising, but it should be, because it's the architectural equivalent of a homemade aircraft shooting down an F-18. Companies spend millions of dollars to build office buildings for a single purpose, to be a good place to work. And yet, people working at home in places that aren't intended to be workplaces ended up being more productive. This proves something a lot of us have probably suspected. The average office is a miserable place to get work done. And a lot of what makes offices bad are the very qualities we associate with professionalism. The sterility of offices is supposed to suggest efficiency. But suggesting efficiency is not the same thing as actually being efficient. The atmosphere of the average workplace is to productivity what flames painted on the side of a car are to speed.
You'll find links to Graham's essay and to the audio from his entire half-hour keynote in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. I have the best of both worlds. I get to work for O'Reilly, and yet I get to do so out of my own house. My commute to work is climbing the stairs to the third floor. Efficiency, sure. There is, however, a downside to not having those hallway conversations, and that's where you come in. If you have feedback on something you've heard here on Distributing the Future, email us at future@O'Reilly.com or use our listener line at 206-350-0383. Pete of California emailed us about last week's show on the Sony DRM case. Our coverage focused on the security hole that was introduced when you played one of the protected CDs. When you're listening to music that you'd paid for from a large and reputable distributor, we found it unreasonable to expect that you should have to worry about what way it might be compromising your system. Pete wrote, quote, "I felt that the episode re-Sony BMG did the issue a disservice by burying the salient problem under a lesser and more confusing one. The primary problem was that they invaded the customer's privacy without warning. It's unacceptable, should probably be illegal, and deserves a strong reaction from the public and the government on both moral and financial grounds. Important issues demand clear and forceful explanations." He continued, "Most of us don't want our home electronics reporting back to the mothership. What we do at home is our business. If some people want to sign away their privacy for some reason, fine, as long as the deal is clear. But a secret invasion by a publisher? Unacceptable, reprehensible, and given the security hole created, perhaps criminal." End quote. Although we should have included the phone home feature in our story, we still don't think it's important as the other violations. Much of the software I buy phones home for updates. Mac OS X, for example, lets me know when there's a security update. We tend to think that's a good thing. You could argue that software behaving this way is reasonable, but music behaving this way is not. Following up on Paul Graham's point, it turns out that a great resource for the Sony DRM case is Mark Rusinovich's blog. His posts have been more informative than traditional media's. Check out www.sysinternals.com/blog. On November 1st, Mark said this about the phone home issue. Quote, "I dug a little deeper and it appears the player is automatically checking to see if there are updates for the album art and the lyrics for the album it's displaying. This behavior would be welcome under most circumstances, but it is not mentioned in the EULA, is refuted by Sony, and is not configurable in any way. I doubt Sony is doing anything with the data, but with this type of connection, their servers could record each time a copy-protected CD is played and the IP address of the computer playing it." End quote. More recently, he's written that he may have declared victory too early as, quote, "The CDs containing the XCP rootkit technology are still widely available, there's still no sign of an uninstaller, and comments made recently by the president of the Recording Industry Association of America, RIAA, make it clear that the music industry is still missing the point." End quote. Thanks again to Pete for sending us feedback. Send your email to future@O'Reilly.com or call us at 206-350-0383. Finally today, we return to the topic of open source. Ernie Prabaka of Apple looks back at how open source grew from infancy to adulthood, what has changed, and what is important to customers who want to use open source.
I think of it as part of a life cycle that open source is going through. Open source, when I was a child, lived in research labs and organizations like MIT and Berkeley and places like that, and they can do pretty much whatever they wanted within very tight constraints. And then with the emergence of Linux and Apache and all this open source software and the whole term open source in the mid to late 90s, it was sort of the adolescence of open source. And suddenly all these people found themselves with their own car keys, if you will, and they could stay at all hours and do all sorts of wonderful things. We saw this huge explosion of open source innovation, all different scripting languages, all different technologies, all different platforms. It was a very exciting time, and a lot of programmers, a lot of system administrators felt very empowered by all these wonderful things that they could do. But now we're hitting the end of adolescence. Suddenly open source is realizing it can't just stay out all night partying with its friends. It has to get up in the morning and wear a tie, manage business processes, keep quality, manage second generation effects, and become the legacy technology in some areas. And so suddenly we're realizing we can't just be independent. we have to be dependable. And I think that's really the challenge, is how do you, you don't want to move back to your parents' basement and become a child again. You don't want to get locked down into the old corporate world where you just took your source from whatever vendor gave it to you. You want to be able to maintain some of that vibrancy and all those wonderful things you discovered during this adolescent phase, but carry that forward into a career where people can depend on you, where they can rely on you. To use open source wisely means understanding what is the business problem you're trying to solve and which pieces of the stack are most important to you. We're finding a lot of customers, they're becoming MySQL mavens, right? They understand the ins and outs of MySQL. And as long as they understand that well, they don't care what operating system they're running underneath or what applications they're running on top. Other people are becoming J2EE mavens or PHP mavens. And they're discovering that their business value is coming out of this level of the innovation stack, and these other levels of the stack don't matter at all. And the sooner people realize that, where their value is coming from, the more they can optimize their business processes and their strategy around where they're really getting value and not waste time and energy throwing money at areas of the stack that aren't really benefiting them. The way I think about it is in the words of the great American philosopher Stan Lee, with great power comes great great responsibility, right? And I think a lot of us grew up in that world. And I think what open source does, it puts a lot more power in the hands of the information technology professional. And that's a wonderful thing. But with that power also comes responsibility. And even more, the responsibility to understand which power you want to take on, right? If you take on power from the vendor by managing everything yourself, you suddenly have inherited all the support costs that you were previously yelling at somebody else for. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, people are yelling at you about those issues. And so trying to understand that there's great opportunity to take responsibility for things that previously were outside your control, but also you need to figure out how to appropriately outsource the right levels of maintenance. And one of the biggest things is really your technology destiny. Is before, if you had a vendor, that vendor determined your destiny. They told you your right. future. And now that is not longer the case. If you adopt an open platform, an open standards-based environment, an open source-based environment, suddenly you're in control. You can choose to use people, and hopefully you use them wisely, to provide pieces of that stack. But ultimately, you are now responsible, and you have to be more rigorous, more foresightful, more of an adult, really, right. in terms of figuring out what's going to happen going forward. I think the real challenge is realizing that there's two different types of innovation that happens in organizations. One is what I would call foundational innovation. These are the platforms underneath that people build things on top of. Right. Scripting languages are a very powerful example of that. Perl and Python have all these modules that people have written on top of them, and they provide a foundation for people to innovate on top of it. What happens on top of it is what I call functional innovation, doing new things that people have not done before. And what you find interestingly is that functional innovation rarely takes place in the open source community as a whole. It takes place in little microcosms of small development teams, either at large corporations or small IS shops, where they try and build something new that solves a particular business problem. And I think the real challenge is trying to outsource as much foundational innovation as possible to people who can do that well, who understand your needs, will create you a nice platform that you can build upon, and then allow you to focus your resources on the functional innovation that will help your business. And finding partners who understand your business, often in niche verticals or in certain tool spaces, that allow you to do your innovative job of meeting your unique problems better than your competitors. And trying to find partners that you can work with, trying to find vendors who will say, I don't know everything about this space, but I know your space well enough, and I understand you well enough, that I can give you a reasonably well-defined architecture that you can then build upon. And finding the partners who can work with you to give you those appropriate architectures that are tailored to your mentality, to your development space, I think is going to be key. Because if you're trying to deal with a whole sea of open source on your own, or you fall back into the old world of just hiring one person to do all your thinking for you, either way, you're going to miss out on the benefits.
Ernie Prabaka of Apple on open source. Links to the original program are included in our show notes at OReillyNet.com/future. Distributing the Future is brought to you by Make Magazine, technology on your time. We're betaing this new show in public so that we can benefit from your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@oreilly.com or phone our listener line at 206-350-0383. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at www.batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.